Quiet, please.
Ladies and gentlemen.
You ready for the big show?
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Lars. This is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one badass president. He secured the border at a level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
So the only people that are crying are the mediocre white boys.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm always glad to get to your phone calls and your emails at 866-HEY-LARS. Well, if you didn't think that the state of Oregon could make things worse than being the sanctuary state, the one that pioneered the idea of providing special protection for people who are illegally in America, and Oregon ranks as the number one state that did it first back in 1987. But could they make it worse? Well, the answer seems to be yes. And State Representative Alex Scarlatus joins me now from Southern Oregon to talk about Senate Bill 599A. Alec, welcome back to the program.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
So tell me what this thing does.
So what this does is basically expands the state's sanctuary state status to now requiring that landlords comply with sanctuary state status. So if you're a landlord in Oregon, you cannot let anyone at the federal government know if you have an illegal alien at one of your properties. And of course, this becomes an issue because the landlord, if they know that someone is an illegal immigrant or has committed laws or broken laws and is illegal, they are now caught between federal laws and state laws. If they report them, they're breaking this new state law. And if they don't report them, then they're harboring an illegal immigrant, which is a federal violation or law that they're breaking. So it really kind of puts them in between a rock and a hard place. And, I mean, coming on off the heels of all of these stories that we're hearing in Oregon about all the terrible crimes that illegal immigrants are committing, it's terrible timing.
Is this thing going to pass? I want to just cut to the chase there, and then we can talk about the details. But, I mean, given the Democrat super majorities in both houses, is this thing going to get passed and signed by Governor Kotek?
Yes.
And yeah. What do they do at that point? I mean, I've always understood, because I'm not a lawyer, but that federal law trumps state law. So if you say, I have to comply with federal law, but then at that point, the landlord could be charged by the state of Oregon for violating this new law under Senate Bill 599A, and then he or she would have to go to court and prove to the judge, I had to comply with federal law, and federal law trumps state law. Or does it work that way?
I don't believe it works that way. The state would just say, simply, we don't care. You violated state law. We're prosecuting you over it. They would have to, you know, take it up the court system to try to get any kind of redemption. And again, maybe down the road, if there was a case that ever reached it, it might go up to federal court, you know, the Ninth Circuit, maybe the Supreme Court. But, you know, that could take years. And in the meantime, the state of Oregon can charge people for this.
Representative Scarlatus, I feel like calling you Alec because we've known each other for so long, but tell me this. Do you think this thing is even constitutional? Can you actually tell somebody, because you own a rental property, the state is allowed to tell you who you may or may not speak with?
Yeah, exactly. I don't think it's constitutional. And again, there's already federal laws on the books that trump these state laws. There was a guy in June of 2022... Saul Nunez Vega shoved his girlfriend during an argument and injured her severely. He was charged with felony domestic assault. Oregon released him on $750 bail and then gave him a deferred sentence. And then a year later, he was caught in possession of two firearms as an illegal immigrant. And, you know, of course, instead of, you know, revoking the deal and prosecuting him, they allowed him to serve less than a month in jail and then reinstated his deferred sentence. And, of course, he's not deported yet. And that was as of January 2025. And the Justice Department is just now charging him. I mean, this doesn't have to do with that case directly. But if you're the property owner and you know that this guy's living there, you know he's, you know the police has been called to your residence several times because of him, you know he's an illegal immigrant, you want him out of your building, but you can't do anything about it because you can't report him to ICE and have them remove a violent illegal immigrant from an apartment complex that you own or a house that you own. You can't do anything like that because then you're in violation of state law.
But it's just... It also seems odd. A landlord could call the police and report any other crime that somebody has committed. They could report, hey, there's a guy I know who's a felon who lives in my apartment, and he's a felon with a firearm. That's a state crime, as well as being a federal crime. He could report that the guy is pouring motor oil in a stream, which is a violation of federal law or state law. I mean, in other words, every other crime is reportable by a landlord except being in the country illegally.
Exactly. And the most hypocritical thing, of course, is that, as you know, we're passing all these terrible gun laws in the state of Oregon. We already have a lot of terrible gun laws on the books, yep. But yet this guy who's a domestic abuser and in the country illegally violated gun laws with two illegal firearms, and he's given like a month in jail. I mean, the state of Oregon's not serious. They're passing all these laws like this bill, 599, about landlords. It's like all this stuff is just virtue signaling to their base, and they have no intent of really following up with anything unless, you know, it's a conservative landlord reporting an illegal immigrant. Then in that case, they'll probably prosecute him. But if that illegal immigrant's caught with two illegal firearms, they won't do anything about it. It's the saying, for my friends, anything, for my enemies, the law.
Yeah. And by the way, Alec, about a million years ago, I owned a little duplex, and so I was a landlord for a while. It makes me wonder about liability. What happens when somebody gets hurt or killed, and then the landlord is sued saying, you knew that a dangerous criminal was present in your apartment complex, and you did nothing about it? It would seem like it would put them on the hook potentially for major liability.
Well, I think it would, and again, hopefully his defense would be that he couldn't do anything about it because of Oregon state law. But even on the best case scenario, if that homeowner has insurance, then the insurance company gets sued, and just like everything else going on with, you know, illegal immigrants driving without a license or without insurance and getting in car accidents, just like that, if the homeowner had insurance, it would just get spread out. The cost would be spread out throughout all the other home insurance payers, and that's why part of the reason why insurance has gone up so much is because we're paying for all of these stupid little things, not just with illegal immigrants, of course, but we're just paying out for all of these ridiculous claims, and everyone across the board, whether you have illegal immigrants in your apartments or houses or not, are paying into things like that, and it just makes no sense.
No, it makes no sense. Alec, I appreciate the time. That's State Representative Alec Skarlatos, who represents Southern Oregon near the Winston area. We appreciate you coming on the program. We will be back in just a moment. I'm glad to get your phone calls and emails at 866-HEY-LARS. Naysayers always go to the head of the line. Anybody out there in favor of a bill that tells landlords you can't report an illegal alien who's living in your apartment complex or rental house? I'd take that naysayer any day of the week. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show. President of the United States always knew where to put the blame.
You have blamed mistakes of the past, and you have blamed the Congress. Does any of the blame belong to you?
Yes, because for many years I was a Democrat.
This is the Lars Larson Show. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. I don't know about you, but it seems as though the folks in Gen Z are constantly traumatized by almost anything and everything they come into contact with that they feel uncomfortable about. They They have almost no tolerance for anything that doesn't fit their point of view and their choice of the facts. So I was really intrigued when I saw the documentary called The Coddling of the American Mind. So I thought we'll talk to the director of it, Ted Balliker, who joins me now. Mr. Balliker, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me, Lars.
Before we get into the documentary that you've created out of the book, the New York Times best-selling book, by two authors, as Jonathan Haidt and Greg Lukianoff, are we accurately seeing Gen Z, if we see them as being traumatized by everything, triggered by everything, set off by everything, and incapable of actually operating in a society in which not everybody agrees with them?
Yeah, unfortunately, too often that is the very sad reality. They just kind of crumble in the face of things that us older generations never thought of as a big deal. You know, coming across someone with a different point of view, a different opinion. Unfortunately, universities are really catering to this. So they're actually removing, for instance, speakers they deem controversial or problematic to kind of hamper them intellectually and make sure that they never hear anybody who disagrees with them.
Isn't that setting them up a bit when they get out into the real world and I can guarantee them that not everybody is going to agree with their point of view, and some people are going to push back, maybe rhetorically, I don't mean literally push back physically, but they're going to disagree with folks and they're not going to be shy about telling them. What are they going to do at that point?
Well, unfortunately, too many of them, I think, are going to just kind of retreat to the same old stuff, having meltdowns, losing their minds. We've seen all the viral clips. We saw it again when Trump got elected the second time. It was like a replay from 2016. So they can, and that's the problem. You identified it really well. The universities can only shield them from reality for so long. And then someone like Trump or someone with a different point of view seeps into their worldview, seeps into their reality, and they just can't handle it anymore. It's tragic to watch.
Well, it makes you wonder, because most of the people who are running the universities, most of the staff and the faculty and everybody else and the board of trustees of most universities are not from Gen Z. So do they realize what they're doing to these kids?
Yeah, it's a great question. And we've been doing a lot of university tours with this movie, so we see it firsthand. I think they're slowly coming to the realization of what they're doing. I think a lot of the administrators today were kind of in that 60s radical camp, you know, back in their college days. So they have mixed feelings. They kind of they're the ones setting up and spoon feeding them kind of this progressive worldview. So to the extent that the students agree with them there, they agree with the students. But then on the other hand, they're just inundated with mental health complaints and concerns. And a lot of them feel overwhelmed by what really is a mental health crisis.
By the way, I'm talking to Ted Balliker, who's the director of the new documentary called The Coddling of the American Mind. I guess what it brought to my mind was that moment, and it's captured, it's been shared on social media so much, of Ronald Reagan, when he was governor of California, say, you know, the problem really began when some of you decided you could choose which laws you follow as long as it was in the name of social protest. So the problem isn't necessarily new, but back in those days, the people who decided to run counter to culture or the law or anything else at least knew there was something else out there, and it wasn't necessarily an illegitimate point of view just because it wasn't their point of view.
Right, right. And unfortunately, the so-called adults in the room are really teaching these intellectual bad habits, so that they are coddling these kids. They're overprotecting them. They are, as you point out, they're teaching them that you don't have to follow, you know, you can kind of follow the rules you want to follow. We've seen, you know, with this fiasco in Columbia and Harvard and other places where students are not just protesting, they're not just exercising their First Amendment rights. They're actually getting violent towards people they disagree with. They're shouting down speakers they disagree with. They're actually gumming up the works of what a university should actually be doing, which is exploring different ideas, having debates, and thinking things through. Instead of doing that, they're screaming and shouting and even, unfortunately, getting violent.
Yeah, and in fact, Mr. Balakar, I went to college for a couple of years. I didn't finish. But one of the selling points at the time I was at the end of my high school time was come to the university. You're going to have every point of view in the world. I mean, you can find an economics professor who's a Marxist. You can find one who follows, more sensible people like Thomas Sowell, and everything in between. And so how did the universities, do you think, lose that point of view that we should be a marketplace for lots and lots of ideas, expose you to all of it, and get you ready to go out in the world, no matter what your point of view is?
Right. Well, I think a lot of it comes down to the departments themselves. So when I graduated college, for instance, in the mid-90s, it definitely leaned left, but it wasn't this monoculture that you see today. Back then, it was like maybe 2-1, 3-1 Democrat to Republican professors. Now, like 17-1 is very common. You get like 50-1 in certain fields like anthropology. Republicans have gone extinct. And so I think if you have, like, let's say an English department and like 51% of the professors are left wing, it's very easy to go from 51% to like 99% because they keep voting in people who agree with them, frankly.
Well, in fact, what is there a solution to all this? And by the way, I do want you to tell a couple of the stories. Let me do that first. Kimmy, the Ugandan immigrant.
Right. Yeah, she came to the U.S. for college, as so many international students do. She was well-traveled when she arrived in New York. When she arrived in Los Angeles, where she went to university. She loved America. She thought it was the friendliest place she had ever been to. But it only took a few months at an American university to totally switch her around. And just a few months into her university experience, she was convinced that the world hated her because she's black and because she's a woman. Because, of course, as we all know, America is
systemically
racist.
Systemically
racist, as they tell us constantly. And so what these progressives on campus, both in the administration and faculty, they think they're really doing black and brown students like Kimmy a great service, but they're really undermining their happiness and their sanity. Because imagine waking up every morning thinking that the world hates you, that the world's out to get you, and that every single interaction that you have, even as minor as somebody, it could be somebody walking the dog, and you're walking along the sidewalk, you encounter someone walking the dog barks at you. And Kimmy, as she says in the movie, she would interpret this as the dog is racist against her.
Unbelievable. That's Ted Balakar. Ted is the director of a new documentary called The Coddling of the American Mind. Mr. Balakar, thank you very much. I appreciate the time. I'll get to your phone calls and emails. You're listening to the Radio Northwest Network and the Lars Larson Show.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show. The Lars Larson Show. Gun control explained.
Want to stop drunk drivers from killing sober drivers? Ban sober drivers. That's how gun control works.
This is the Lars Larson Show. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. It's a Monday. It's the Radio Northwest Network, and it's my pleasure to be with you. Now, there are sometimes stories that I run into that seem so crazy, they almost seem like they were written by the Babylon Bee, like there's some kind of big joke. But the idea that if Oregon changes the law, if I understand this right, you would only be able to buy cigarettes at a liquor store or a weed store run by the OLCC or under the jurisdiction of the OLCC. I don't smoke cigarettes. I don't smoke weed. So I don't have a dog in either one of those fights. But John Charles joins me now, president and CEO of the Cascade Policy Institute. John, welcome back.
Thanks, Lars.
Would Senate Bill 702 really limit it that way to say to everybody who smokes cigarettes, which is still, I think, about 18% of the population, you have to buy your cigarettes at a weed store or a state liquor store?
Yes, starting July 1, 2026, The bill would prohibit sale of flavored tobacco and nicotine products in Oregon except at liquor stores established by the OLCC. And there are 282 of them. So that would be a 90% reduction in choices for purchasers of those products.
Now, that's only for the flavored variety. So if you're not smoking menthol cigarettes and you're not smoking, I don't know, vanilla cigarettes or something else, if it's just straight tobacco cigarettes, those would still be for sale in regular stores?
Well, I believe that's the case. The bill says prohibits the sale of flavored tobacco and nicotine products.
So. And puts it under the jurisdiction of the Oregon Liquor Control, Oregon Liquor and Cannabis Control Commission, right?
Yes. So it's designed to make it more difficult and expensive to buy those products. And that's the point of this. And the advocates, I mean, they would prefer to ban all of these products everywhere. And that's, I'm sure, what they'll continue to work towards. But this is one of their many interim steps to make it more difficult, more expensive to buy products they don't personally approve of.
Is it actually going to bring that about, John, do you think?
Well, there is. Well, if it passes, it will certainly, but based on research, people will have to drive further to find a location because it's going to reduce access. And some people will buy less because they can't afford to drive more. Actually, it'll have a disproportionate impact on Blacks and Hispanics and poor people in general. But the Legislative Revenue Office also predicts, and I have the report in front of me here, that over the biennium, in 27-29 biennium, the state would lose about $36 million of tobacco tax revenue and about $33 million in the 29-31 biennium. So it's interesting that from the standpoint of politicians, they just love to get more money from people smoking, drinking, and gambling because that's what they live for, is to spend someone else's money. And that competes with the advocates or the supposed purpose of this bill, which is to promote public health. So I think this bill might not pass. It's actually in the committee right now. It hasn't reached the floor of either chamber. It might not pass out because it would reduce tobacco tax revenue, and legislators just love to have revenue.
So in other words, the lawmakers are okay with it inconveniencing people. They're okay with the other parts. They're just not okay with the part where the state loses money.
Right.
Wow.
I've actually argued with a colleague, not a colleague, but someone in the industry about this. He said, John, we don't want you to smoke the cigarettes. We just want you to buy them. Buy them legally, that is. They're taxed. They just want the money.
Now,
they don't care about you.
What do they imagine is going to happen when you can't buy flavored cigarettes, especially for the biggest population center, the Tri-County area around Portland? Aren't a lot of those consumers just going to hop across the river and buy there?
Yes. And there are 448 testimonies submitted on this bill as of a couple of days ago. And hundreds of them are people opposing this who have explained this in great detail to the legislature, that if you do this, you just drive people into the underground economy. Maybe they go to some Indian reservation, or they go across the river, or they go somewhere to get the things they want. You're just annoying them, and you're also depriving yourself of revenue, and you're putting hundreds, if not thousands, of people out of work by all of the stores that, I mean, many of these stores exist to sell only one product. And now you're taking the product away. So, but for the advocates, and I've known a lot of these advocates for years, I mean, you can't reason with them. Appeasement doesn't work. If you let them do this today, next session they'll be back with some more extreme measure. So it's kind of irrational, really.
Well, and it's funny, has anybody raised the issue that this is in particular going to hit one particular demographic group, and that is the group that apparently 85% of the menthol cigarettes are sold to Black Americans? I mean, it's not just a stereotype. The numbers actually bear that out. I looked them up a couple of weeks ago when the subject came up then, and you say, who smokes menthols? You say, primarily Black Americans. So you're going to say, so white Americans can buy the cigarettes they want at the local convenience store or anywhere else they want to buy it, but Black Americans have to go to a weed store or to a booze store, one or the other.
Well, as far as the advocates are concerned, You know, we're doing this for your own good. So they don't care, Lars. They don't care.
When are they going to slap a limit on sales of French fries and hamburgers and milkshakes?
Don't give them any ideas.
Wouldn't that be for their own good, too? Let's have a tax on milkshakes and a tax on French fries made in Eastern Oregon or Eastern Washington. I mean, this is the kind of insanity we're up against, and all of this being presented as public health. Do you think there's a real agenda there somehow that I'm missing?
The real agenda is power. People involved in politics are addicted to power. And if they can force some group of people to do something that they don't want to do, that really makes their day. It's all about power. This bill is a solution in search of a problem. There is no problem. All tobacco products are heavily taxed and heavily regulated, and the consumption of tobacco has been declining for years. They should just walk away and do nothing.
Well, in fact, am I correct? The last time I did the math, the states and the federal government make more money off cigarettes than the cigarette companies do. Isn't that still true?
I'm sure that's true. I'm sure that Oregon is still selling bonds backed by future tobacco sales revenue, which means if tobacco consumption went down to zero, we would be defaulting on the bonds. So Oregon legislators are really more addicted to tobacco tax revenue than tobacco producers are.
Unbelievable. So it may not get through this session, but usually in that case, they'll just take it to the next session and reintroduce it and hope to sneak it by when nobody's watching.
They will always have another bill. They always want more.
Unbelievable. Well, I got to tell you something, and they never seem to run out of tax revenue ideas because
how much money they have, they will always want more. Yes.
Yeah, and it's funny, when you look at other states that run on far less in tax revenue per citizen, and there are states like Idaho and about 12 others that have been cutting taxes lately, while both Oregon and Washington have been finding excuses to increase the taxes on their citizens. And I think you're right. Half of it is about the money we put in the pockets of state bureaucrats so they can spend it. And the other half of it seems to be about, well, we're going to make people do something that we tell them to do. And then they'll turn around and say, oh, you evil conservatives, you're just trying to tell us how to run our lives. No, it seems to be the Democrats have a pretty good monopoly on that one. John, thanks very much. That's John Charles, President and CEO of the Cascade Policy Institute. You're listening to the Radio Northwest Network and the Lars Larson Show.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Hey, if you're even...
I know y'all think it takes balls to be singing what I'm singing, but I'm just saying what you're thinking.
This is the Lars Larson Show. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. There's a strange way of approaching the task of trying to make your state number one. Now, let me suggest that when California, according to the public opinion polls of small business owners, only 13% of those small business owners are happy staying put in the Golden State. The problem is, if it's 13% now, and then you add the anti-ICE, anti-America, anti- or pro-illegal alien riots to the mix, what's going to happen to those small business owners that were still happy in California? I thought we'd talk about it with Red Balloon CEO Andrew Krapuschets, who joins me now. Andrew, welcome back.
Hey, Lars, how are you? Nice to talk to you, and thanks for having me.
Now, I'm glad to do it. So tell me what you think of that idea. If you had a public opinion poll, as you did, in 2024, yep. 80,000 small businesses are surveyed, and only 13% of them are happy about being in California. And now you have all this nonsense going on, and God knows when it's going to end, maybe soon, I hope. But maybe it's going to go all summer the way it has 5 years ago. What happens to all those small business owners and their, commitment to stay in California?
And 13%, like, you need to put that in context. Everyone thinks, well, small business owners, no one's ever happy with where they are. But of the 80,000 businesses that we surveyed nationwide, over 50% were happy where they are. And if you looked at states like Florida or Texas or where I live in Idaho, we were seeing over 60% of businesses said, no, I really like where I am. I feel like I've got, you know, good tax support, good small business support. And so for California, which is the lowest state in the country, to be at 13%, that's a real problem. And many of them said, I'm trying to move, but I can't afford to move. And of course, it's not a surprise. High tax rates are a big one. But then the next one is this anti-business culture and then high crime rates, high energy costs. And then this one's actually interesting. The third reason that they wanted to get out of the state of California was woke public schools. So basically, the whole infrastructure in California, not just the crime and everything else, but the schools, were driving them out. So now take all that information and apply it to where we are today with the riots going on. Well, if crime rates were such a big deal and looting and all the things they're associated with, and a police department that doesn't have the power and doesn't have the backing to be able to enforce the laws, of course those people are trying to leave right now. And so I think this is actually only going to accelerate that. It is going to accelerate the small businesses, particularly conservative small businesses, who just can't afford. They're going to run the math, and they're going to realize staying in California anymore just doesn't make sense.
Well, and in fact, to that context you added, should I assume that most of these small businesses are likely to be either retailers or service providers as opposed to, say, manufacturers?
Well, actually, this is across the board. So obviously the people who are dealing with the high crime rate, that was primarily retail because they're trying to deal with that. But the businesses in the survey were a very broad subsection. So it was manufacturing, it was farming, and all of that. And I did think that the fact that the woke schools were one of the main drivers for wanting them to get out, I think it's a really big deal. The other thing that's interesting, Lars, is we actually just did a partnership with Law Enforcement Today, which is one of the largest conservative law enforcement groups out there, to figure out how do we help police officers who are stuck in places like California find a job in police departments and cities where they're actually going to have the city council and their police chief back them up and say, no, if you commit crimes. I mean, we saw what the Florida police officer said, you know, if you try and assault one of our officers, we're probably going to shoot you, and you just need to kind of deal with that. So anyway, we're trying to help, but man, it's a mess in California.
Well, and in fact, I know you're trying to help, but I can also see that California then drives itself further into the dirt, because if those officers who say, okay, I'd like to relocate, I would assume these are people who want to go out and actually enforce the law. And that means departments in California lose them. Who do they hang on to? The man or woman who, you know, for whatever reason, if they're told go out and don't enforce the law, go out and don't arrest people, go out and don't do all the things that police usually do, but they love the paycheck or they love the climate or they love, you know, the benefits, the retirement benefits and such, then you end up with a department full of non-law enforcement people doing law enforcement, which makes the situation even worse. I'm not criticizing what you're doing. I'm just saying that California could see it losing all the people who are the best cops that you'd want to have, the ones who come to work fired up, ready to go out, enforce the law, and get tired of being ground down by bosses that keep saying, because I know a number of those people. They'd say, well, I was going to bust this person, but I was told by my boss, don't, and literally told, don't do the job. Those people want to get out as fast as they can.
And we see this everywhere. When you have big cities like Chicago or all over California, where you say, look, we don't want small businesses because we're driving with taxes, or we don't want these officers who actually want to enforce the law. Well, you lose those people, and then you actually are going to fill those jobs with people who maybe are moving into California, but they're moving there for the benefits and the signing bonus, not to actually enforce the law. It's going to be a vicious circle, and honestly, I don't know where it's going to end, right? What does this look like going down the road? At some point, when does the state of California just turn into a third world nation, and then we have to kind of figure out, okay, now what do we do? They're part of their country, or do we just give them to Mexico? Tell you what, we'll do a trade.
Let's not. Because we bought them fair and square. We bought California long time ago. We paid them $15 million, which would be about a half $1 billion today. And that's Andrew Krapuschet. He's the Red Balloon CEO. And Andrew, I very much appreciate you coming on the show. You're listening to the Radio Northwest Network and the Lars Larson. 193.
You ready for the big show?
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one fat-ass president. He secured the border at a level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
So the only people that are crying are the mediocre white boys.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you on a Tuesday. Chinese students in the United States are often legally required by their home country to provide intelligence back to the Chinese Communist Party. Should ICE begin deporting these students to protect national security? I thought we'd put that question to our friend Frank Gaffney, president of the Institute for the American Future and author of number one best-selling book on Amazon in the category, The Indictment, Prosecuting the Chinese Communist Party and Its Friends for Crimes Against America, China, and the World. Frank, welcome back.
It's great to be with you, Lars. Thank you.
Tell me this. In some ways, aren't we contributing to the moral hazard that we put students in if we say we're going to admit Chinese national students to go to our universities, and we know that back at home they have not just a legal responsibility to bring things back for the Chinese Communist Party, but we also know that the Chinese government is not beyond, you know, say, threatening the family of that student. So if you let them in, you're either, acknowledging that they're going to steal information and take it back to benefit the Chinese Communist Party, or their families are going to be threatened, and that's morally questionable, isn't it?
I believe that this is a huge problem on multiple levels, as you say, Lars. For one thing, it's a threat to the national security of the United States that you've got, by some estimates, 270,000 of these young people who are obliged under the laws of China to do whatever the Chinese Communist Party tells them to do. And by the way, they've all been selected by the Chinese communists to come to the United States. They don't get in because they're, you know, dissidents or going to waver. And if there is any question as to whether they're going to do what they're told, there is now apparently some number, and we don't know quite the number, but some number, more than one, of these so-called overseas Chinese police service centers that are intended to keep these guys in line, not least, you mentioned the families back home, by bringing them in, and they're on a big screen in the service center, as they call it. You're likely to see your grandmother or some other loved one from China who is in the not-so-tender company of the Chinese authorities. And the message is very clear. You will do what you're told, or something bad is going to happen to your family. So that's a moral hazard, yes, but it's more than that. It's creating, I think, real threats to the nation. And, you know, this came up recently in connection with the Trump administration telling Harvard, you're going to, you know, have to get rid of those foreign students. Not get rid of them, but have them transfer. You're not going to get visas for more of them. And this should be, it seems to me, the opening salvo in a corrective that is long, long overdue, because these Chinese nationals, I think, are ticking time bombs, perhaps more than just collecting intelligence, by the way. I mean, if it happens that the Chinese party says, blow up that local transformer in the U.S. grid, well, they have to do that, too. Very serious stuff.
Yeah, if they don't, they're violating the law. So when they go back home, it's not going to be a friendly reentry to their home country, and they're putting their families at risk. That's an untenable situation, and we're participating in it by allowing them to come in, go to our universities, and then be obliged to steal information To take back to China. So it, I don't even see a way to solve that other than saying, then you're not welcome to be here.
Yeah, I'm afraid that's the only solution. And it's not a happy one, and especially for these universities who charge full freight to these Chinese students. Many of them are coming from wealthy families who, you know, can afford to pay the full fare, no scholarships for them. But another piece of this, Lars, that shouldn't be overlooked is they're not coming here to study, English literature or American history. They're here to learn hard sciences, and I think you can't get around it. They're going to take it back, and they're going to use it against us. That's what this so-called civil-military fusion in China is all about. Even if they don't go to work for the People's Liberation Army directly, any job they're going to get that takes advantage of what they've learned here in the way of chemistry or engineering or physics and the like is going to be applied to a commercial enterprise which also works for the Chinese Communist Party and also is responsible for, you know, building the military might of China. And what is that military might going to be used for, Lars? It's going to be used for their efforts to destroy the United States and seek world domination. That's what the Chinese Communist Party does.
Well, see, and for all the people who advocate for this, you know, let the students in. We've got the best universities in the world because they'll stay and go to work, say, for a high-tech company. I mean, there's constantly this claim that you might be telling the person to go home who's going to come up with the next cure for cancer or the next innovation in some field. The problem is, if they leave that university with that freshly minted PhD and say go to work for an American tech company, there is nothing, absolutely nothing, that says if they work for the tech company for 5 years or a decade and then return to China, they're not going to return with all that knowledge in their head, not just from the university, but also from working for with the tech company here. And all of that goes back to China, too.
Well, of course. I mean, this is not just a hypothetical. It happens a lot. And sometimes they get caught. Sometimes the companies only figure it out after they've returned to China with essentially a motherload of proprietary information. But, Lars, that law that we were talking about isn't a law that applies to students. It's a law that applies to Chinese nationals. And, by the way, those overseas police service centers go after first-generation Americans in yep. some cases, as well as Chinese nationals. So this is, again, whether they leave with the knowledge that they get from us in our academic institutions or they leave with the proprietary information they get from working for our companies, it's, again, I'm afraid, ticking time bombs, and I think we have to be done with it in a time when the Chinese are making no secret about their intent to destroy us, the Chinese Communist Party, that is.
And by the way, Frank, I was going to mention to you, we do a week of broadcasts at Hoover, which is the conservative institution on the Stanford campus every year. And one of the publications there is the Hoover conservative paper on campus. And they broke a story. And it had a person impersonating a Stanford student who was befriending mostly young ladies and saying to them, why don't you go visit China? It would be very enlightening and all that. Oh, and by the way, I'll buy your airline ticket. And they suspected that he was perhaps working for one of those outfits. And whether he was approaching first-gen Chinese kids at the Stanford campus or otherwise, the point is that he was trying to get them to go to China, saying, go over, you know, stay a couple of days, and then come back, and I'll pay the freight. I suspect that that person was working on behalf of the Chinese government as well. That's Frank Gaffney. Frank, thank you very much.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show. They talk about serious issues, but even Lars has a sense of humor.
I have a joke for you. The government in this town is excellent and uses your tax dollars efficiently.
This is the Lars Larson Show. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you and lend an ear to my friend Aaron Mesh, who is managing editor at Willamette Week. Aaron, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Not too bad. Tell me why there is a gigantic population of snow monkeys living in Hillsboro, Oregon.
It's a very good question. So it goes back to 1964 when Japanese authorities in a town called Mahara rounded up the monkeys that were eating crops and annoying the local farmers. And sent them across the Pacific Ocean to the Oregon National Primate Research Center, where they've been breeding ever since. They are one of the two main kinds of monkeys that the Primate Center does its animal testing on. And there are now 446 of them as of September 30, living in Hillsboro in a curving concrete enclosure by the same architect that designed Big Pink.
I love it when we build things that should be kind of ordinary and commonplace, like, say, an animal shelter, and you bring in a big, expensive architecture firm to design it. I suppose there's not much point in going back and visiting why this Japanese problem became America's problem, but you know, more to the point, why are they keeping them around? Because the story that Anthony Effinger wrote, and I read it, it was a good read at WWeek.com, Anthony writes good stuff, is he basically said, most of the researchers say, yeah, we use the other kind of monkeys, and we don't use the snow monkeys. They're not good for much, and they're not comparable to humans in most cases. So what would we use them for? So they've come up with all these bizarre uses, like getting the monkeys pregnant and then having them smoke weed to show what it does to the unborn baby, which I think you don't even need a scientific study to say it's probably a bad idea to smoke weed. Well, it's a bad idea to smoke weed anyway, but it's an especially bad idea to smoke it when you're pregnant.
I think that it would be fair to say that the consensus of the people that Anthony talked to is that a lot of this research on the snow monkeys looks like make work. In other words, that this is trying to figure out what to do with them, and so coming up with things that you could do with them, right? Like, it's that classic sunk cost fallacy of we have them, and so we'd better research on them. The trouble, again, is that, like, it's actually other kinds of monkeys that are the scientific consensus of who you should be doing the research on, which means that it's actually kind of hard to compare the tests being done on these monkeys to the tests being done at other facilities, which again leads to the kind of work that maybe isn't solving real problems.
Well, a long time ago, I had a research scientist that I was talking to for a story I was doing, and he said, oh, you wouldn't believe the Norway rat. And he went on and on about the Norway rat, because over the decades, science has said we need a rat that is the same rat in, you know, any place that's where research is being done on planet Earth. So they very carefully bred this strain of Norway rat. So when they do a test on a Norway rat in Germany and one at the Wuhan Institute of Virology, for example, or one in Portland or Seattle, that it produces the same results. That's not true of the snow monkeys, is it?
No, it's not. And the most researchers prefer what's called a rhesus macaque. And I'm probably pronouncing both of those words.
No, I think you got it right. Macaque is right.
So the researchers prefer rhesus macaques, which are from South Asia. OHSU has those, but also has Japanese macaques, which, again, are not the same animal and don't offer the same, like, What's the term when you have, like, a baseline in scientific research, a control?
So
you need the control that we have a control subject, and then we have somebody who's taking the experimental medication. And if you don't have a control that matches the patient who's receiving the new therapy, you're not going to get results that are useful for further research. The next question, of course, is if you're not going to use these monkeys for research, what can you do with them? And
let them live out their lives and don't encourage them to make more baby monkeys? Just an idea.
You could, in fact, perhaps, and I do think there's a strong argument for this, spay them. you could not have.
Oh, now you're going to get all the emails from PETA, aren't you?
Oh, I mean, I get emails from everybody. Like, that's just all I get. Is like I just have a junk mailbox that fills with people who don't like me.
You know what's funny too is, Aaron, an awful lot of animals don't live as long in captivity as they do in the wild. But I just, while we were talking, I looked up the number. In the wild, these things last about 6 years. In captivity, they last about a quarter to a third of a century, which means we're stuck with them for a while. But why they turned 55 monkeys into 400 monkeys that they don't have much of a research purpose for, it just confounds you. And I can understand why some of the groups decided to make that part of the big argument to blow up the deal between Legacy and OHSU.
Yeah, and I mean, like, so we've talked about this before, but this is definitely a moment where, for the first time in my memory, there's a real possibility that this facility will be shut down or reduced in scale. The change of the National Institutes of Health would suggest that PETA now has, and other critics of this monkey facility, now have the ear of the head of Health and Human Services and the Surgeon General nominee, who, by the way, went to did her residency at OHSU, as you know.
Yeah, I do know. And then quit in the middle of it, saying she lost her enthusiasm for it or something like that. Seemed kind of crazy to me.
I want to give her more credit than that. She essentially lost faith in the contemporary medical system.
So she's decided to go to work in the government, which has more trustworthiness than the medical establishment?
Look, it's the president's decision who he wants to nominate.
I know, and I wasn't crazy about her nomination, believe me, nor the kind of business activities she and her brother have been up to. But when I read about her background and that she said, yeah, she goes to medical school and then comes to OHSU and does a four-year residency, is coming near the finish line and walks in and says, yeah, I'm just not into it anymore, and walks out. Oh, okay, great. I hope she doesn't do that with her current gig, or maybe I do.
It's not to me the best sign. I'm going to tell you that I remain fairly skeptical of her nomination as well, at least in part because I tend to prefer people who finish the things they start.
Yeah, and that's a good thing too. But what happens at the end of this? I mean, other than what do you do with the 400 leftover monkeys? Where do you send them? I was thinking the number just happens to almost exactly match the number of representatives in the House back in D.C. Right. We could, you know, and I'm sure they would produce more. Maybe be more productive than the current crop that's back there right now.
You know, they say that if you put 400 monkeys at 400 typewriters and give them enough time, they will produce the works of Shakespeare. Maybe they will produce a big, beautiful bill that we can get the government working on.
I never thought I would hear the words big, beautiful bill come from the lips of Aaron Mesh. He is the news editor at Willamette Week. You can find the story by Anthony Effinger. But this just sounds like a gigantic, colossal waste of money. Plus, I imagine the money for the monkey feed, I'll bet that was part of an NIH grant, and I have a feeling the NIH grants are going to be few and far between. Aaron, thank you very much.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show. The Lars Larson Show. What a vegan actually is?
They say cows are bad for the environment because all they do is eat plants and fart, just like vegans.
This is the Lars Larson Show. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you on the Radio Northwest Network, and it's always my pleasure to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. Our X poll today, should ICE hold back on arresting illegal aliens inside of federal courthouses that were put there for decisions about legal matters? I said no, they should not hold back. The Daily Dead Fish Rapper and Therese Bottomley apparently think they should. I want to talk about urban planning. Now, don't let your eyes glaze over, because Randall O'Toole is the smartest guy I know when it comes to issues like transportation and land use, director of the Oregon-based Thoreau Institute. But he doesn't sit out by a lake and write books that nobody's ever going to read. He writes stuff. He works with several think tanks, including Cascade Policy, and author of several books, including American Nightmare, How Government Undermines the Dream of Home Ownership. Randall, welcome back.
Hi, I'm glad to be here.
You wrote about this, and you wrote about how the fact is that the Portland metro area has so many layers of planning for the future, and almost all of it has turned to naught. Actually, it's made the conditions for people who live in the Portland metro horrible, by your account, and I would agree with you.
That's right. Metro is Portland's regional planning agency, and back in 1997, they published a plan that was supposed to make housing affordable for everyone. It was supposed to make job opportunities accessible to everyone, and had all these grandiose goals. And since then, on every single measure, the quality of life in Portland has declined. And in almost every case, that decline can be traced to Metro's plan. The plan made everything worse that it was claiming to try to make better.
I mean, they said, as you said, build up, not out. So make a very tight, compact place and jam as many people in as possible. That's my language, not theirs. You know, force multifamily housing into neighborhoods that were formerly single-family homes. Don't build any freeways. Just build more transit. All of these things that were supposed to make life wonderful and make Portland a utopia have turned out to actually be destructive to that very life. Or to their quality of life.
Totally. And the amazing thing is, at heart, they really knew this was going to happen in the first place. In 1993, 4 years before they wrote their plan, but while they were still contemplating it, they did a review of the 50 largest urban areas in the country to see which one comes closest to what they wanted to turn Portland into. And the one that came closest was Los Angeles.
What?
Turns out Los Angeles has the highest densities, it has the fewest miles of freeway per capita, and it's building the most expensive rail transit system of any major urban area in the West, and that was what they were trying to turn Portland into. And they actually wrote that it's kind of peculiar that when we talk to the public, they all say they don't want Portland to become like Los Angeles, and yet that's what they're doing. That's what we're doing here. And it never occurred to them that maybe that meant they were doing the wrong thing. Instead, they just decided that Portlanders just couldn't appreciate how wonderful Los Angeles congestion really was.
And by the way, you point out that one of the ways they planned to make dense housing, or one of the goals was, let's make sure we build the densest housing we possibly can. So lots and lots of multifamily, lots of condos, not so many single-family homes. And actually, single-family neighborhoods are effectively outlawed today because anybody who wants to under the state laws can come in and say, I'm going to build a big apartment complex in the middle of all these single-family homes, and the state law will support them doing it. But by doing that, they drove through scarcity. They drove the cost of housing through the roof, didn't they?
Yes, they did. And it's funny. People think, well, multifamily housing, that's going to be less expensive than single family housing. But these 4 and 5 story apartment buildings they're building are costing twice as much per square foot as a single family home. So at the same time, 80% of Americans want to live in single family homes. They don't want to live in apartment buildings. So they are tearing down single family homes that people want to live in and that are relatively cheap in order to build multifamily homes that are relatively expensive that people don't want to live in. That's not going to make housing more affordable. That's going to make housing less affordable, and it has.
By the way, Randall, I want you to back me up on this because I may have an imperfect recollection of what you told me once about this light rail nonsense they're building right now. I mean, I think it's dumb on many levels. But one of them that's so easy to understand, but you do a better job than I do, is that because of the size of Portland and the size of its city blocks, and because they chose to have all lines of light rail all come in to the city and have to loop through the city, there's a finite number of trains you can put through that city. And I thought I remembered the number, even at the maximum you could imagine, was maybe 20 trains an hour. And that may even be high, except that they now have a north line. They have a west line. They have one south line and soon to have to Milwaukee and a second one that's going to Tigard. And they have one from the west. So if you have 5 or 6 lines all running in and you can manage only maybe a maximum of 20 trains an hour, because they can't all jam up on each other, then that means you're not going to have very many trains per hour coming from anywhere, even during rush hour. Do I remember that one right?
That's exactly right. So the lines branch off on the east side, and so if there's three branches and you can only run 20 trains an hour downtown, that means you can only run 6 to 7 trains an hour on each of the branches. And as you point out, Portland has the smallest downtown blocks of any city in the country. They're 200 feet long, and a light rail car is 95 feet long. So you can't run more than 2 light rail cars in a train, because if you do, you're going to block a street every time the train stops to load and unload passengers. So that means Portland's light rail has the lowest capacity of almost any rail system other than streetcars in the country. You can only run 20 trains an hour. You can only run trains that are 2 cars long. Each car can hold 150 people. So that works out to about 6,000 people an hour. Portland's downtown bus mall, before they built light rail on it, could move 12 to 14,000 people an hour. And when they built light rail in the bus mall, they actually reduced the capacity of the mall to move people per hour, because the light rail is displacing buses, and it can't move as many people as buses.
Well, right now, so the North Line,
what I call a low-capacity, high-cost system that is, you know, a total waste of money and is not very effective at moving people around Portland.
Now, Randall, right now the North Line runs the Expo Center, and nobody lives at the Expo Center except homeless people. But if they manage to put the $2 billion extension and run into Southwest Washington, into Clark County, that they say they're claiming thousands and thousands of people will ride this thing every day, except the numbers can't bear that out, do they?
Well, they don't, because, you know, there's employment centers all over the Portland area. And the light rail is focused on downtown. It's basically the same as the streetcar lines we had over 100 years ago. Everything went downtown. And over 100 years ago, that made sense because all the jobs were downtown. But now, only about 6 or 7% of, or maybe it's 9% of all the jobs in the Portland area are downtown. And that was before the pandemic. Now it's even less. And so we're running an expensive, a really expensive transit system that can only possibly serve about 9% of workers in the area. And in fact, only about 20 or 30, maybe 40% of people who work downtown take transit to work. Only about 5% of people in the rest of the urban area who don't work downtown take transit to work. So we've got an expensive system that only works for one part, little part of the city, and it is a low-capacity system besides.
Absolutely. That's Randall O'Toole, a land use and transportation policy analyst, director of the Oregon-based Thoreau Institute, and he also works with Cascade Policy. You're listening to the Radio Northwest Network and the Lars Larson Show.
You're listening to the best of the Lars. At least someone has a plan for illegal aliens.
Back in the White House, I will terminate every open borders policy of the Biden administration and begin the largest deportation operation in American history.
This is the Lars Larson Show. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. You know, the risk of blackouts is exactly why President Donald Trump declared an energy emergency on day one in office back in January. Will his plan to open up millions of acres in Alaska for energy exploration actually bring jobs and power for the 49th state as well? Bob Griffin joins me now, board member for the group Future 49, which is focused on making life better for the people who live in Alaska. Mr. Griffin, welcome to the program.
Well, Lars, thanks for having me back on to talk about this topic. It sure is heating up a lot, especially a big conference up here in Alaska this week. And we had Secretary Burgum, Secretary Zeldin, and Secretary Wright all up tours of the North Slope and kind of getting a lay of the land and a better understanding of some of the things that we can do in Alaska for the energy dominance that President Trump has kind of put as one of the top shelf agenda items.
Is it getting a generally positive reaction from the people who live in Alaska as permanent residents?
Oh, absolutely. It's there are a few wingnuts here and there, but generally we're a resource development state. It pays for 90% of our state government, and you find pretty strong bipartisan support for resource development because it's where our bread is buttered. And even the Democrats have come to realize up here is that we do resource development incredibly responsibly. It's our job sites up on the North Slope and Crook Inlet and other places we do are some of the cleanest in the world. So if the world needs hydrocarbons, you can get it from places where they don't do it as responsibly, or you can get it homegrown in Alaska that has very short supply train routes to our strategic partners in the Pacific.
Do these people, the wingnuts, and I agree with that description, but do the wingnuts understand that this is a clean operation and that we have to have the energy? Or are they just, you know, absolutely opposed to any kind of energy development, no matter how clean it is?
Well, I think there's a demographic out there that's not going to be happy until we're all living in mud huts and burning donkey dung to keep warm type of things. But we have the same type of horror scenarios that were talked about when the original Trans-Alaska pipeline was supposed to go back in. That people were fighting against it and all these apocalyptic predictions of what it would do to the nature. And frankly, none of those things came true. As a matter of fact, it's what the wildlife around the Trans-Alaska pipeline has thrived over the years. And it's been a very beneficial operation, not only to the state of Alaska, but we've made a significant contribution to energy independence for the United States.
Well, you know, it's funny, Bob, because you're talking about the arguments back in the 70s, right? Or was it the late 60s? Because I was a little kid at the time.
Well, I was a youngster up here, too, when the pipeline was going in. Little known, remembered facts of the fact that the Trans-Alaska pipeline was only approved by a tie-breaking vote from Spiro Agnew back in the 1970s.
When he was in the Senate? Is that when he was in the? He broke the tie as vice president. That's right.
Broke the tie as vice president, or we wouldn't have the Trans-Alaska pipeline back then or at that time, and. No, apocalyptic predictions have not come true. We were able to build the pipeline in 2 years and 2 months. There's a lot of folks that are saying, "Oh, the oil pipeline would take at least 10 years to build."
It doesn't have to. I'll bet two years and 3 months wouldn't get you through the NEPA paperwork these days, but maybe we can cut that red tape.
There was some significant red tape back in the day, too. I think the United States has to get back into that mode of just getting things done as well, too.
Well, and in fact, you know, you raise an interesting possibility. Let me throw this at you as an idea. If you said you can go ahead and we'll conditionally we'll do a fast track on NEPA, but if it turns out that something, you know, was done wrong or there was a mistake or there were flaws, then you have to go back and fix them. That's not a problem, is it?
Yeah, I would seem pretty reasonable to me. You know, 2 years and 2 months that they did it was from an undeveloped route. Right now, the pipeline route that they're proposing is basically paralleling the Trans-Alaska pipeline. So that infrastructure and routing is all, you know, in place. So this project should be pretty simple. It's a very expensive project, you know, that ranges $40 billion to $44 billion. I think about $11 billion was just for building the pipeline. The rest is for other infrastructure aspects that would have to come along with that. So, you know, the payback period, since the dollar per BTU for gas is a little bit less than oil, would be a little bit longer. So it would definitely have to be a private-public partnership. But it looks like there's the will and the need for energy dominance that get it done this time around.
That's Bob Griffin. Bob, thanks very much. Board member of the group Future 49, which is focused on making life better for people who live in Alaska. And, of course, as a side benefit, it makes life better for all of us as well, because all of the United States needs energy, and I'd rather buy it from Alaska than buy it from, say, Saudi Arabia or Venezuela.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
You ready for the big show?
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Lars. This is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one badass president. He secured the border at a level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
So the only people that are crying are the mediocre white boys.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a Monday on the Radio Northwest Network, proudly serving the Pacific Northwest states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho these past 25-plus years. And I'm glad to get to your calls. I'll do that in just a moment at 866-HEY-LARS. And naysayers, you go first at 866-439-5277. Send emails to talk at LarsLarson.com. Vote in our X poll. And I want to explain the X poll a bit, because I'm thinking that most of you heard over the weekend that Joe Biden got a diagnosis of prostate cancer that has spread to his bones. Do you think that Joe Biden and his family lied about just now learning that he has cancer? They dropped the news on a Friday, and almost every doctor who's commented on this, who's an oncologist, has said this is the kind of cancer that develops over 5 to 7 years. It does not happen between Joe Biden's clean bill of health, which he got from his own personal doctor February of last year as he was running for re-election at that time. And now you don't have a cancer like that develop that quickly. Do you think that Joe Biden and his family lied about just now learning he has cancer? Today's X poll found at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com, and brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at UltimateTruckService.com. Now, I want to welcome Mark Harmsworth back to the program. Mark is director of the Small Business Center at the Washington Policy Center. Hey, Mark, glad to have you with me.
Thanks for having me back on, Lars. I appreciate it.
Now, tell me this. I'm a fan of nuclear power, both in weapons for our military and in nuclear power to generate electricity. An awful lot of greenies and liberals don't like the idea at all. Why did Washington Democrats, who claim that they're all about adding jobs and clean energy, why in the world would they block a brand new $3.5 billion nuclear manufacturing investment in the Tri-Cities?
Because they don't like nuclear, and they think that we can power everything with solar and wind in Washington State, and somewhat with a hydroelectric as well. But the actual bill itself, which made it all the way through the House with a strong bipartisan support, 81 representatives supporting it, when it finally got to the Senate, went through the process, the Senate leader, Jamie Peterson, decided, because he doesn't like nuclear, that this thing was going to die. And so with just by killing it in the rules process, he wiped out a potential $3.5 billion investment, and their estimates are around 1,200 jobs in the Richland area, which is a crying shame. This isn't a nuclear reactor. This is a manufacturing plant. It would have been great to start making us one of the premier places to do nuclear development and manufacturing and those types of things. So those jobs, at least for now, are done. And the actual change was so simple. It was just increasing the amount of time a company had from 24 months to 48 months, so it matched the federal requirements. And then on top of that, the actual tax incentive that's in here was local dollars. It wasn't even even legislative dollars or statewide dollars. So it's kind of silly they've done this, because this would have created a lot of new jobs in the area and really put an extra kick in the economic development there.
I mean, just so I understand what they were offering, I mean, there are lots of local communities in the Northwest, both Oregon and Washington, who will offer tax forgiveness to companies to bring in giant server farms for the likes of Amazon and X and a lot of other companies that have to run these giant server farms. And all they do is provide a very small number of jobs, and they chew up a gigantic amount of cooling water and electric energy. And here's a company that would have come in and made major nuclear components for manufacturing plants that make electricity, not necessarily the plants themselves, but the pieces that go into them. And the local community could have said, yep, it's worth forgiving X amount in taxes to get 1,200 new high-paying jobs into our region. And the legislature said no. Or at least Jamie Peterson said no.
Yeah, that's basically it. And we had Democrats that were supporting this on both sides, in the Senate and in the House. And, you know, this is one of these economic development zones where you target specific industries. Like Marysville in Washington, for example, is doing this for aerospace because they're very close to Boeing. So when you do these type of incentives to, in this particular case, extending this deadline so that this facility could meet its federal requirements and get built in time, then that's great. But in this case, they decided, no, we're not going to do that. You know, so this bill isn't completely dead because of the way the legislature works in Washington. It'll be back next year. So I'm really hoping that the legislators can sit down. It does have a couple things that need to be tweaked on it, but they need to sit down and reconsider this and get these jobs created.
Okay, did Jamie Peterson explain what the antipathy toward nuclear is? Is it I'm concerned about waste, I'm concerned about danger of the plant itself? Did Jamie Peterson explain any of that in leading the charge to kill it?
No, and a lot of it is anecdotal conversations that have happened in the halls of Olympia that I've heard from other people just saying, yeah, he just killed it because they really want to focus on green energy, which is ultimately, in Washington, we're one of the greenest states for electricity generation because of a hydroelectric. We're 80-90% in that range. You start adding in the nuclear components we've got right now and wind and solar, which is a very small percentage of what we do here. And we're one of the cleanest in the nation. And yet, this, which will help us move forward because of the mandates that the state has for electric cars, we're going to have huge amounts of electricity demand in the next few years if they can even get to this electric car idea. We're going to need this power. And, you know, it's just, we've seen projections where we're currently a net exporter of energy to California during the summer when they need it for their air conditioners. That's going to start dropping down because we're not going to have enough electricity, particularly with facilities like the data centers we've got in Moses Lake in eastern Washington, where they're going to be consuming a lot more electricity as well. So we really need to up our production, and it's ridiculous that one person can stop this.
And by the way, most of the green energy has had to be subsidized, or they just don't do it at all. And that applies to windmills and solar panels, which are almost exclusively made in Malaysia and China. But these are components that would be made in America, and most of that giant investment of $3.5 billion would be private dollars, would it? Would it not?
That's absolutely right. This would have cost the state almost nothing other than the inconvenience of having to pass a bill. So it really is kind of a poke in the eye to the folks over there in Richland, where this would have been a great job creation mechanism and would have helped out lower rents and get the economy rolling over there.
Well, I'll tell you what, we will, as we always do, we'll extend an invitation to Jamie Peterson to come on the program and explain why kill jobs, why kill private investment, why are you doing this? Do you think they're not going to build this plant somewhere else in America and then the jobs will go there instead? I'm not going to hold my breath for a Democrat like Jamie Peterson to come on, but heck, if Jamie Peterson feels strongly about this position, he should be willing to stand up and defend it. That's Mark Harmsworth, Director of the Small Business Center at Washington Policy. Mark, thanks very much.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show. A message from Lars.
I'd like to apologize to anyone I've not offended yet. Please be patient. I'll get to you shortly.
Who's next? This is the Lars Larson Show. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Well, we're more connected than ever before thanks to the internet, and that's a good thing. But the internet carries with it the downside, which is all that screen time that is hurting our health. And I wanted to talk about it with Dr. Henry Miller, who joins me now from the American Council on Science and Health. He is a medical doctor, molecular biologist, and was founding director of the FDA's Office of Biotechnology. Doc, welcome back.
Good to be with you, Lars. Thank you.
So is there a way of actually measuring how much of this damage people are doing to their health by using the internet incessantly?
Well, not directly. You know, I think the real problem is not screen time. It's the quality of what people glean from their screen time. And it's a real dilemma because there's so much information, including disinformation and misinformation out there. It's very hard for people who are non-experts to know what to rely on. I struggle with that for areas that I'm not knowledgeable about. And I certainly sympathize with people who don't know where to go for good advice about public health or vaccination or drugs or quote-unquote wellness.
Well, do you know where to go? Because you'd be the one, right? Physician, heal thyself. So where should you go? Because, Doc, before the internet ever existed, if you had a serious diagnosis from somebody that had serious consequences from a doctor, people would always advise you, even the doctors would advise you, get a second opinion, get a third opinion. And oftentimes the opinions were different. And I can't count the number of friends who've had treatment for cancer or other serious, you know, problems who've told me, well, the first doctor wanted me to do this, but another doctor said, no, this is a better solution, and I went with that one. Is that does that mean the first opinion they got was a misinformation and the second one was correct, or vice versa? How can anybody tell?
Well, not necessarily would the first one be bad information. In fact, it might be the other way around. It used to be, as you said, used to be very different. You would ask your doctor or you would ask the local pharmacist maybe to get an opinion that was pretty well informed on some subjects. I do have places that I go to find out what's new and up to date on certain subjects. So I go to the websites of some of the academic medical journals, New England Journal of Medicine, the journal Science, and the Nature family of publications. Now, everyone can't appreciate the nuances of the articles in those journals, but you can get a pretty good idea often from the abstract and the introduction and the conclusions without delving in to the methods and the statistical implications of the results and so on. And there are others that are much less technical. Websites like the NIH and CDC, at least in the past.
Can I ask you this, Doc? I mean, I used to be, as you know, you and I have talked about this before, I used to regularly read a thing called Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report that came out of the CDC a long time ago. And mm-hmm. I thought it was very informative because I'd read stuff that was, you know, somewhat useful. And it was about how people get sick and how people die. And it came out every week and it was interesting. But how do you know which one is going to be the right piece of advice to go with? Or do you just go with whatever works for you?
Well, whatever works for you might not be accurate, and we're seeing that all the time with information on the internet from wellness influencers and social media celebrities and so on, and that's the real danger. So, I read some commenters some websites religiously and find them to be consistently accurate. So the National Foundation for Infectious Diseases, NFID, is a good one. Dr. Eric Topol, T-O-P-O-L, from Scripps Research Foundation in San Diego, Paul Offit at University of Pennsylvania, and so on. The Cleveland Clinic and the Mayo Clinic websites are often very, very good. They have sections on many diseases and current developments that are intended for the public that non-experts can understand.
Well, let me throw a major one at you, all right? You have a kid in your family. You're a husband and wife. You have a young son or daughter. And the young son or daughter says, I think I'm a different gender. And they may have picked up the idea on social media. They may have picked it up from school or their friends. And if you listen to some of the major journals, I think APA was one of them, was American Pediatrics. They say, yep, proper diagnosis is take them in and help them transition from male to female. Now, I think both you and I think that's junk medicine. But there are a huge number of journals that have tied their future to taking that stance that, yep, the right way to treat that kid, give him a puberty blocker, maybe effectively sterilize them, and even suggest and assist them in cutting off body parts. If that's the kind of stuff we're getting out of some of those journals, should I trust the rest of the things they talk about?
Well, you know, you brought that up last week during our discussion, and all I can tell you is that's not an area that I follow closely. And
okay.
And if I had a kid who was in that situation or thought he or she was, I would go to several real experts for their opinions.
Doctors.
Doctors.
That kind of gets me to the second problem. The second problem is when you go to those doctors, they've been told, you are not allowed to counsel that child. No, you're really not going to be a girl. You're a boy, and we're going to help counsel you. It's literally illegal in some states. So politics has entered it, and the politics of the medical journals and the politics of the medical world. So you say, I want to find a doctor who can help counsel my son that he really isn't, shouldn't be changed into a girl or daughter into a boy. And you say, you can't have a doctor like that because politicians made it illegal. And an awful lot of the doctors say, no, we don't believe in that kind of counseling. Now, if you want to be counseled on how to change from boy to girl, yeah, we'll counsel you on that all day long. And that's what medicine is serving up, and that's disturbing. It's not just the journals, it's the doctors themselves, isn't it?
That's one that I can't solve for you. I'm taking the easy ones, like treatments for glioblastoma and other cancers, and I say that ironically, and infectious diseases and whether or not to vaccinate and whom to vaccinate. So I can tell you that the sources that I've mentioned, the National Foundation for Infectious Diseases, Eric Topol, Paul Offit at the University of Pennsylvania, Jeremy Faust at Harvard, the Cleveland Clinic and Mayo Clinic, have been consistently accurate, informative, and comprehensible for people who are non-experts.
That sounds like a good test. Dr. Miller, thank you very much. That's Dr. Henry Miller from the American Council on Science and Health.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show. The Lars Larson Show. And now, this musical message to anyone who wants to indoctrinate our school children.
Hey, teacher, leave them kids alone.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
And welcome back to First Amendment Friday. Your phone calls and emails are welcome at 866-HEY-LARS. You know, I got to tell you something. I think there are about 100 different ways that Tina Kotek's governorship of Oregon has been a complete train wreck for Americans and for Oregonians in particular. High taxes getting higher, wildfires that happen every year that are completely preventable, and then funding a $1.5 billion of health care for illegal aliens. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. And most of these are self-imposed mistakes, errors that are being made by Tina Kotek And they're not small errors. They are errors that actually hurt citizens. And I wish she would stop it. But there is another part of what she's doing in the governor's office that so mimics some of the biggest scandals of the last few years in the Northwest, like Governor Kitzhaber, who decided to let his girlfriend peddle favors out of the office. And you say, how is it that people like Kitzhaber, people like Shamia Fagan and others have engaged in corruption right out in front of God and everybody, and they end up getting away with it? Well, what's Tina Kotek doing? Perhaps hers is not as lucrative, but she promised a year ago that she would not involve her wife, they're lesbians, but she's her wife, in policy decisions. And now, this week, we find out, Amy Kotek Wilson is going to be doing exactly that. And I thought I'd talk to Jeff Eager, because he's a guy who follows this a lot more closely than I do. He's the former mayor of Bend, attorney and political consultant. You can find what he writes on Substack at Oregon Roundup. Jeff, welcome back.
Thanks, Laura. It's great to be here.
Is my memory gone, or did Tina Kotek not promise, okay, having tried to insert her wife, her mentally ill by her own account, alcoholic by her own account, wife, into the governor's office, she said, I'm not going to do that anymore. And now, less than a year later, she's doing it again?
No, that's exactly what happened. Was on May 1st, 2024, Kotek held a press conference kind of apologizing in a way to Oregonians for putting her wife in a position that her wife was not qualified for, and then being dishonest about it. I think this is all about dishonesty, the scandal is. And now here we are just a little over a year later, and the governor's office announced that Amy Kotek Wilson, Tina Kotek's wife, is heading this behavioral health talent council that goes sideways with what Tina Kotek told Oregonians she was going to be doing going forward.
I mean, not only that, but Jeff, when voters hire a person, they hire Donald Trump, they hire, you know, Bob Ferguson, not a good decision, but they did. They hire Tina Kotek. They're hiring the person who's supposed to manage problems. And then they do something, even if Amy Kotek was not involved in this. She takes a committee of 22. They're going to figure out how the state can hire more mental health professionals. Go out and hire them. And if there isn't enough money, or you've got to offer them additional incentives, then do that. Or privatize it and farm it out to the private sector. Isn't that a problem that is supposed to be solved by a governor? And if the governor isn't doing a good job, the legislature can pass a law and tell the governor how she has to do it, or the governor can actually do it. But taking a problem and hanging it off to a 22-person committee is bad enough, because it's suggesting the governor has not a clue as to how to solve this problem, even though Tina Kotek has been involved in government for decades now, and she's now the governor, the person in charge, and she doesn't have a solution, so she ships it off to a committee that'll probably take a year or better to come up with a report that they can then ignore for a couple of years, all the while the problem isn't solved. Am I missing something?
No, you're not missing anything, Lars, except for the beginning premise of the committee to begin with, which is that to solve Oregon's just crushing mental health and addiction crises, that we just need to hire as many people as we possibly can. I'm not convinced that that is the solution here.
I agree.
But Kotek is, and so, but she's going about it in an extremely strange way. To me, this all feels like just a position that was created to give Amy Kotek Wilson a relatively high-profile role in the governor's administration once again.
I mean, it kind of suggests that there is something toxic about, and I understand, most of the time, Jeff, I think you could hold me to this, I don't explore the, the family relationships. Hunter Biden, yeah, he's an exception. If your son is running around doing cocaine and prostitutes and, illicit deals overseas, he's fair game. But otherwise, I stay away from people's families. I don't think it matters. But in this case, if you've got the kind of toxic relationship where somebody runs for governor, says, I want to be in charge, and then her mentally ill, and it's Amy Kotek who's described her mental illness, and alcoholic wife says, I want to have a role in the governor's office, or whatever word she used to communicate that, and the governor can't stand up and say, hey, I'm running the state, I'm not going to give you a job. If that creates problems in the Kotek household, maybe Kotek needs to submit a resignation and move on to another job. But if she can't do the job and can't control her family, and if Oregonians have to be put at risk and spend a lot of money, we've already spent a few $100,000 on Amy Kotek's whims, then she's doing a disservice to the public just to keep her wife happy. Right. Am I really hope I'm not right about that, but correct me if I'm wrong.
It sure feels that way to me too, Lars. And it's not just the money that this all has cost the state. Tina Kotek lost her top staffers last year because she insisted that Amy Kotek Wilson needed a top role in behavioral health policy in her administration. And those folks all quit. These were the hand-selected people that Kotek thought were the best people to run the state until they got sideways with Amy Kotek Wilson. So, and now we're a year later doing where Amy Kotek Wilson, and I agree with you about what this looks like from internal dynamics at Mahonia Hall, is, you know, she got a year off. Like, she had to take a year break, Amy did, after the political blowback from last time, but now she's back in the saddle.
Well, the other thing about this is weird. Jeff, I've worked in radio for 50 years. I think I'm reasonably good at what I do. Would you put me in charge as the general manager of a radio station? That would be stupid. And you say, but Lars, you've been in it 50 years. Doesn't mean I know how to run the organization. Would you make me the head of a big media company? No. Because this is what I do, but when Amy Kotek Wilson, her credentials seem to be, number one, she's an alcoholic. Number two, she's mentally ill. Number three, she's been a counselor. So you're going to put her in charge of systemic changes for an entire state in a multi-billion dollar agency? I mean, that's crazy, isn't it?
No, it is crazy. There's no way that if Tobias Reid ran against Tina Kotek in the Democratic primary in 2022. If he had won that primary and he was our governor right now, there is 0.0% chance that Reid would have hired Amy Kotek Wilson to do anything in his administration, let alone take the leading policy positions that she's had in her wife's administration.
And yet most of the legacy media, Jeff, and I'm glad you're writing about this, I'm glad I'm talking about it, they don't want to say anything to Tina Kotek. And I think part of it is she's a liberal Democrat in a Democrat state. She's a lesbian. They don't want to question that. She's got this relationship that appears to be toxic and weird. And they don't want to say, hey, what qualifies your mentally ill wife to be the head policymaker or head up a committee to make policy for the entire state? They don't want to ask that question, even though it's the question you'd ask, hey, the new head of Ford Motor Company, what qualifies him? Well, he used to be a guy who worked in an oil change place, so he's worked on cars for a long time, so therefore he can run an automobile company. That's the logic that's running Oregon. That's Jeff Heger. Jeff writes at Oregon Roundup on Substack. He's an attorney, political consultant, and the former mayor of Bend. You're listening to the Radio Northwest Network and the Lars Larson Show.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Hey, it's Doc.
People always ask Lars if he wants to run for public office, like president.
Do you know how much power I'd have to give up to be president?
This is the Lars Larson Show. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. My old buddy, J.D. Hayworth, former member of Congress, but he's trying to live down that reputation. He was six terms as congressman from Arizona and a veteran broadcaster as well. J.D., it's been too long.
Lars Ubub, it sure has, pal. I am so glad to be back with you, and I would be remiss if I did not thank you for those scores of occasions where you allowed me to guest host. And I hope you'll keep me in mind as my schedule frees up. So I look forward to that sometime in the near future.
No, we're going to do that more often because, J.D., you've always been a great guest host, and my audience appreciates you. And I don't get nearly as many complaints as I get when I use somebody else. But I want to ask you about something else. You've got,
sure.
I mean, I swear that we could have solved America's prescription drug problem a long, long time ago. I thought Medicare Part D, I can't even remember if you voted on that or not, but I never liked the idea. It was like using a sledgehammer to swat a fly. But now you've got Big Pharma trying to put up roadblocks when it comes to making America healthy again. Tell me about that.
Well, it is incredible. And first of all, what you stated is quite true. Now, I voted for adding that benefit back when I was on Ways and Means, but you may recall in those early days, we had market-based reforms to hold costs down.
Yep.
As soon as the sides flipped and I went home, which is fine. After all, the house is not a home. Suddenly, the other guys come in and they always drive it through government. And so that started jacking up the prices, but it's interesting. Let me lay the groundwork, because this is an idea whose time has come. How do I know it? Let's go back to last year. You know, all the pundits, an election year, differences are highlighted anyway, but I don't know. I guess the big word last year was polarized.
Yep.
Okay, so the Kaiser Family Foundation does a poll in that polarized election year. Guess what they find? 89% of Republicans, 84% of Democrats, and 78% of independents say Big Pharma is more concerned about profits than anything else. So you get that. You know, Reagan used to say, if you find an 80% issue, go up and put your arm around it. And that's why the president stepped out last night as the Make America Healthy Again, report was being issued. Wow. I know we concentrated and RFK thing. We talked about the chronic diseases for kids and how we get healthy again.
Yep.
But this report, they went in, did a little forensic accounting. And guess what they found in the report?
What's that?
Pharmaceuticals, that we call them Big Pharma, and not for nothing, they spent nearly $5 billion, billion with a B, on lobbying between 1999 and 2018.
Jeez.
And you may have heard RFK Jr. the other day talk about there's a Big Pharma lobbyist for every member of Congress, 435, every U.S. Senator, 100, and all 9 justices of the Supreme Court. And then you look at, you talk about grassroots. Well, the green stuff growing is not grassroots. Big Pharma, according to the report, spent another $6 billion setting up 20,000 patient advocacy organizations, kind of like Shell do-gooders, to say, yeah, we think you're doing a great job. But here's the bottom line, Lars, and it hits everybody in the pocketbook. On average, Americans are paying at least 3 times as much as our old cousins across the Atlantic in the UK or our neighbors to the north in Canada or any of the, quote, modern developed nations. We're paying at least 3 times more.
Well, let me ask, and it's for the same drug. So, J.D., tell me this. Why do the pharma companies say, we're going to sell this to the UK's socialized medicine or to Canada's socialized medicine at this price, but we're going to charge Americans 3 times as much? Wouldn't you think the pharma companies say, this is the cost of the drug, and we're not charging Americans more than we charge everybody else on the planet? Why are they willing to do that?
Because they've basically gotten away with it. And early on, when I was there, they were talking about research and development. And they say, look, we're pouring money into research and development. Well, we've checked, in my role, and I'll identify myself as spokesman for the Pharmaceutical Reform Alliance, we've done some checking, and they've only spent about, 17% of their profits on research and development, but they've spent close to $36 billion, with a B, on marketing directly to consumers. So you've got that kind of disparity. You couple that with the lobbying full court press they put on, and the fact is they think they can still win on Capitol Hill, but without the American people. Now,
well,
here's the new wrinkle.
Let's prove them wrong, JD, because we gotta rein in Big Pharma, and we gotta tell them if you're gonna charge the Brits $3, then you charge Americans $3. You wanna charge Americans $10 for something, then you charge the Brits and the Canadians the same amount of money. That's JD Hayworth, former 6-term congressman from the state of Arizona. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show. Your emails are welcome. talk@larslarson.com and check out my Instagram feed where you'll find I've got a face for radio.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show. The Lars Larson Show.